Okay, this is Michael O'Rourke with the Oregon Historical Society, continuing the interview with Judge Owen Panner in his chambers on February 9th, 1995. As I was saying, you had as a result of your work on the recovering the McQuinn strip and other things, had occasion to really interact with both local and national political leaders, and I assume that that, to some extent, put you in a position where you were at least visible when the time came around to be nominated. So at least in that respect, I would assume your experience to some extent contributed to your nomination.
No question about that. I've always liked people, and I have enjoyed civic activities. I was active in the Lions Club and band, the Chamber of Commerce, the church, and I was active in the Oregon State Bar. I always attended the bar conventions here in the valley, and we had them up in Bend. And I was always active on the issues, all kinds of issues that the bar considered. I was served on the Board of Bar Governors under a great president of the bar, Gene Marsh, who's uncle of Malcolm Marsh, who's on the court now with me. And I just have always liked people, and I think all of those things had a lot to do with it, because I remember when Al Ullman called me and told me he was going to put my name up for a judgeship. I remember saying, well, there are a lot of better candidates than I am. I'm happy here in Bend, and I don't feel that I deserve it. For example, I said Ed Levy, who's been on the top of all the bar polls. I'd never run on a statewide bar poll at all. I'd been president of Central Oregon Bar and local things, president of the local clubs and so forth. But he said, well, that's not the way it's going to work. There will be a bar poll. You will be on it, and we'll see how you come out. And I remember having a real concern statewide about how I would come out. And sure enough, they did have a big bar poll. And sure enough, properly, Ed Levy was tops of the bar poll. There were 10 or 12 or more on it. I was second, which really surprised me, coming from Eastern Oregon. And Ed was such a great, great man. And he'd been a state court judge in Eugene and a magistrate here in Portland. So he was eminently qualified. And then when Al called me and said, well, it's the committee has met. They had a committee, statewide committee, that appointed by Democrats and some Republicans to come up with three names for the position. No, they came up with seven names. They were going to give seven names, which they did. They turned in seven names to the president. And Al called me and said, well, the president's called me, and you're going to be one of the three that's going to be appointed. And I said, who are the other two? And he said, Jim Redden and Helen Fry, and who I knew both to be wonderfully qualified. I said, well, what about Ed Levy? I mean, he was first on the bar poll. He's the most qualified. I want to take my name out and put him in. Well, he said, that's just not the way it works. He said, I'll tell you this, though, the next time we have a chance, we'll be looking seriously at Ed Levy. And sure enough, he ultimately did get it. But I the point of that is I always felt I was just very fortunate to get the job.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think they passed over Levy that first time?
Well, it was there are some political things also. Ed was a Republican. I was a Republican, but I was Al Ullman's friend. Jim Redden was Attorney General, Democrat, and it was Carter who was doing the appointing. Helen Fry was a wonderful woman judge, and they were looking to diversify. And Helen has always said she was just lucky to be a woman, and I've always said, well, I was just lucky to be Al Ullman's friend. And, you know, those things are political, too. And Jim Redden was, of course, wonderfully qualified, having been Speaker of the House would have been governor. In fact, Attorney General, very popular Attorney General, he was going to be governor of this state, just sure as anything.
Yeah, he was state treasurer, too.
Yeah, state treasurer, yeah. I had a wonderful lot of friends, you know.
Mm-hmm. And did you know Jim Redden then, before?
Yes, I did. I knew him quite well. In fact, he appeared on the Indian fishing cases occasionally when I was representing the Indians, and we were on opposite sides technically, but actually there wasn't a lot of difference, and we had a very friendly relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about just how your appointment came about then. I mean, you mentioned that Al Ullman was the coroner and interested in bringing you, you know, in considering you for this, but I think when we very first talked about this, it wasn't when we were taping the interview, but when we first sat down to get an overview, you had mentioned that that you were a little concerned about Ullman putting your name forward without any conversations having taken place with the senators of the state.
I was. I was in trial over in Baker, Oregon, as I recall, when Al called me, and I said to him then, I said, I thought it was the prerogative of the senior senator of the state to do this. And he says, well, yeah, but we have a Democratic president, and those two are Republicans, and I'm going to take the lead in this. And I remember being very flattered about it, but very concerned, because Senator Hatfield and Senator Packwood were both good friends of mine. I was very concerned that they would, and I knew how senators feel about members of the House taking those kind of liberties. So I called both of them. I called Senator Hatfield and I called Senator Packwood and said, because Al said he was issuing a press release, and I said, there's going to be a press release coming out, and I'm very embarrassed about it, and I want you to know I didn't have anything to do with it. Al's my good friend, and he just got carried away. And I remember Mark laughed and said, I can't think of a better deal, you know. He said, if we can get a Democratic president to nominate a Republican like you, that'd be fine with me. The only thing I'll insist on, he said, as I always have, is I want a blue ribbon committee to screen the names and give us some names, competent names. We're not going to have any political appointments. Senator Hatfield's always done that. As governor and as senator, he has always insisted on a select committee of competent people, Board of Bar Governors, representatives, a broad, diverse group, and to give him certain names, and from those names, then he will pick, so that you guarantee you don't get any real political appointments, just total political appointments. And that was done, and John Schwabe, who's a very competent lawyer here in Portland, was on the committee, Bob Chandler, Edith Green, there were two or three representatives of the unions, there were all kinds of people on the committee, and they had 20 or so names that they considered, and they were told to report seven to President Carter, and so they did.
Did you know most of the folks on this committee then, too?
I knew about half of them, as I recall. And we all interviewed. We came down, interviewed. They asked us what our qualifications were and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Is that's the type of questions they would ask in these interviews?
Yes, and you know, why do you want to be a federal judge, and what do you think your qualifications are, we gave them a memo on our background, and they asked questions about various things, at least a couple of them. One of them was a lawyer from here in Portland that I had had a very tough trial with, and some rather tough feelings, and I remember being quite concerned that he might not think too highly of me as a judge. And Bob Chandler, our editor and publisher of the Bulletin and Bend, just seemed like we were always on different sides of the fence, politically and locally on race, elections and issues. We maintained a pretty good friendship, but it got a little tough at times. I thought when I saw those two that, well, that takes care of that job.
But, this isn't going to work.
But it did.
What was the nature of this tough trial?
It was a trial over. There was a company back in Detroit, Michigan, that manufactured solar heating units for houses. And they didn't work, and I represented all the distributors, and I sued them for a lot of money, and it went on for a couple of years. We took depositions all through the East, Indianapolis, Chicago, Detroit, and here in Oregon, because we represented distributors that had bought this idea and were trying to sell it all over the country, and it was a terrible idea. It didn't work. They all got sued, and so it was a very interesting situation.
And it wound up being a situation where you and the opposing attorney.
We had a lot of conflicts. We had a lot of problems. I perceived them as stonewalling or refusing to give discovery and depositions and harassing me unfairly, and they probably perceived me the other way, mm-hmm. which isn't uncommon in the legal world.
So it's not necessarily always a completely dispassionate process.
Oh no!
Then.
Oh no! On a number of occasions, I've felt very close to fisticuffs in the courtroom, you know. I don't know if I ever told you. Did I tell you about the time that my client choked the other lawyer into unconsciousness?
Oh, I do. I think we
talked about that. Yeah. Emotions get a little high when you feel your cause is justified and you feel the other side is taking advantage of your client, you know.
Mm-hmm. So an attorney who's used to arguing both sides of any question can get into
absolutely.
Emotional involvement.
Absolutely. We lawyers feel very strong about their causes in most cases. Good trial lawyers feel very strong about their causes, and they want them presented fairly, and if they perceive that the other side is not being reasonable, which is pretty easy to do, you know, they get pretty excited.
Mm-hmm. Recognizing that would happen, how would you make a decision about whether to take a case in the beginning?
I always made the decision, I always felt very fortunate this way. From the time I started practicing law, I always made the decision based on whether I thought my client was right or not. My partner that I first started with was a very honorable guy, and we made the decision right up at the first that money would have nothing to do with it. That if a client came in that had a good cause that didn't have any money, to the extent of our ability, we would try to represent them anyway. That we would have the courage to tell people when we didn't think they had a good case. And we did that. I can remember as a young lawyer telling a client who worked for the mill that I didn't think he had a good case, but always when I did that, I always recommended they went to another lawyer. He went to a Portland lawyer who was an expert in that particular field and got a great big judgment. What I learned from that was to just be a little bit more careful even. But I always did. I always believed that you studied the situation as best you can, and if you don't think they have a good case, you tell them so. And I try to teach young lawyers that in the long run they will make better friends and have better clients and make more money if they do that right up front.
Mm-hmm. And just simply not take the cases then.
And not take the case. I mean, you do it in a very diplomatic, nice way. Many times I've said to somebody, you know, I could take this case for you. We could take it through court. There's a very small chance we might win, but the rewards are not going to be worth the emotional problems you're going to have with it and the expense it's going to cost you. And I recommend you forget it now. If you don't want to, I also would urge you to go get another opinion, second opinion.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're talking here mostly about civil cases.
That's right. Criminal cases are different. If you get appointed, I was seldom hired to defend a criminal case. It happened on occasion. But when you're hired to defend a criminal case, you sure don't do it unless you think you can accomplish something within the limits of ethics for your client. If you're appointed to defend someone, you have to remain ethical, but you have to go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm remembering some of these murder cases that you've had, the fellow that was in prison, for instance.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the word came down that you were named to the federal bench by President Carter was that in 1980?
Well, first you get nominated. The president nominates you. That's after they go through a FBI check. They talked to over 300 people about me before the FBI cleared me. I remember my wife saying, "Oh my gosh, they're going to find out about my overdrafted checks." But they even stopped one of my nephews in Atlanta, Georgia, a police officer did, and they picked up his home and his license plate and followed him one day and said, "Tell me about your uncle. Has he ever been a communist or and all this various stuff?" So the FBI does a big check, and then the American Bar Association does a check, and that all goes to the Committee of Congress, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then they have to screen you and put you through a hearing, and then once they decide you're okay, why then it takes place.
Uh-huh. That reminds me of a story that happened recently in our household. We live right next door to an assistant U.S. district attorney, and the FBI came knocking on our door, and my wife answered, and they were asking her questions about Chuck next door.
Yeah.
And she didn't want to answer, so she turned him away. And then she later talked to our neighbor about it, and he said, "Well, it'll be better for me if you go ahead and answer the questions."
Yeah. They went to, I had a wonderful old guy and his wife who were living on the farm where our farm was, and they were feeding horses for us. And he'd been a jockey and a trainer and small horse trainer at places around the Northwest, and his wife too. And this FBI agent came to the door and said, "I'm from the FBI, And this guy had a great sense of humor, and he was just tough as heck. And he said, "Oh, no, you're not from the FBI. You're not from the FBI." "Well, what makes you think I'm not?" "Well, the FBI doesn't have cute young something or other," he called her, skirts or something like that. "Don't tell me that. You're not from the FBI." So she gets out her identification and everything and shows him, you know, and says, "I just need to ask you some questions about Mr. Panner that you work for." "Oh, okay, come on in." So she came in and sat down and got her pad out, and she's writing, and she says, gets to the point, she says, "You know anything bad about him?" "Well, not really. There was that time we had a little problem with a brand inspector about that cow that showed up on the place, you know," and boy, she's writing away, you know, she said, "What was that about?" "Well, I don't know. We never did know for sure where the cow came from, but it had somebody else's brand on it, and that's all I want to say about it, you know." And he took her through two or three other things before she finally realized he was just pulling her leg, you know, completely.
So there was no misbranded cow.
There was no misbranded cow. Oh, there'd been one, but we got it back to the neighbor, you know. He just uh-huh.
Could have been a potentially dangerous game he was playing there.
I liked his comments. His wife told me about, "No, you can't be from the FBI. They don't have cute young skirts like you." Or it wasn't dolls. I guess he said cute young dolls like you or something rather.
Well, so they did your background check, and then what's next in the process? Was that when the appointment was made?
Then you go to a committee hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. and they ask you some questions, and you appear at that hearing. We all three appeared together. For that, the day before, we had an interview with the Justice Department to give us a clue as to the type of questions we'd have put to us and so forth. Then we all show up together, and Senator Hatfield went with us, and Congressman Ullman went with us up to the hearing. And our hearing was not difficult like many of the Senate judiciary hearings that you hear about for Supreme Court justice, you know. Nowadays, they're even tougher for district judges, but ours was very simple. They were very cordial, very friendly, and only lasted 20 or 30 minutes. Mm-hmm.
And then that was it.
Mm-hmm. Then once that's done, then the president signs your commission.
Mm-hmm. You say that the hearings are getting tougher now?
I want to back up. The committee then reports your name to the Senate as a whole, and the Senate votes on you, but that's pretty routine unless there's some controversy. So it goes to the Senate Judiciary Committee. They vote it out. And then it goes to the floor of the Senate, usually on the consent calendar, unless there's a dispute. Mm-hmm. And so the Senate has to approve it.
And your approval by the full Senate was routine then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now you say that there's more that they're getting tougher on district court appointments.
They are. They're this business of judicial appointments has become pretty difficult. And when Judge Jones was appointed, for example, he'd been on the Supreme Court. They reviewed every opinion that he had written and questioned him seriously about some, didn't like some of his opinions, were real nasty. In fact, Friday before he was to appear on Monday, they called him and said, "We want a detailed explanation by facts of these cases as to why you arrived at this decision. And if we don't have that by Monday, the hearing will be postponed." You know, so he spent the whole, these are cases, you know, you have to go back and dig out which ones they're even talking about first. And it was pretty difficult.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to discuss specific cases that you participated in?
Well, I did, because they ask you for a list of the 10 most important cases that you've tried, and what the result was, but ours was very limited. They didn't have any problems. We weren't none of us, except Helen. Helen had been a circuit judge in the state, but they just didn't really question us very much. Mm-hmm. This was before Bork and some of the other Supreme Court things that have happened that have caused them all to get a lot more sensitive to each other's nominations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although I guess just depending upon the political climate and the
That's
specific
right.
circumstances,
there have right.
been incidences earlier too. I know that Judge Solomon was, mm-hmm. his nomination wasn't so straightforward.
No, very difficult. In fact, one of the local judges opposed it. It was a very difficult situation.
Yeah, and that was during the HUAC and the McCarthy mm-hmm. days.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember which 10 cases you listed as your most important?
I don't. I think I might be able to dig those out for you.
Okay, well, that might be of interest.
I'll take a look and see if I can dig them out.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk much with your fellow appointees about the process as it was unfolding?
No, we didn't a lot. We didn't talk a lot about it. I think we talked, but very limited. The way those things work, you don't count any chickens until they're done, because so many things can happen to derail them. And so I think all of us just went about our business. From the time that Al Ullman first issued the press release, way early in the process, it was 3 years until the thing was finally completed. And in the process, in the private practice, I had a lot of interesting situations with clients who weren't sure you were still going to be around, you know, and because the press was full of all kinds of stories, and you just had to go ahead. And it wasn't quite so hard for for Helen or Jim, because they were in public positions already, though it did, to Jim, it was a serious question as to whether he would really wanted the appointment or whether he was going to run for governor.
You think so?
That was no question about it.
Because I wondered about that because there were reports that was true.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, his future as a politician would have been certainly much less certain than accepting the federal.
Well, that's what he decided, yeah. That's what he decided.
That was also an interesting time, because I believe Carter was in the position of appointing more federal judges as a result of an expansion of the district
mm-hmm.
court than any other president in history. So
mm-hmm.
I forget, wasn't it 180-some appointments
mm-hmm.
possibly that he made? It was
mm-hmm.
a large number. Was there anything about that aspect of things that affected things?
No, here in this district, we had one replacement for Judge Scopel, who had gone to the Ninth Circuit, and then we had two of the additional spots made available by the omnibus bill that created the additional positions,
mm-hmm.
and this court was in a real difficult position before we came on, because they just didn't have enough judges. Judge Scopel had left. They were overwhelmed with work, and they were obviously very glad to see the three of us all of a sudden show up and start to work. It made their life a lot better.
Uh-huh. Was there any kind of political about that, any concern that Carter might have undue influence on the
I don't think so. For the most part, the judiciary once the vacancy is filled, they need the judges. And contrary to a lot of ideas, most of us aren't too concerned with whether somebody's political philosophy is Democrat or Republican. The main thing we want to know is that they have good judgment and good background and are capable. It's a little different when you get to the appellate courts. Their political philosophy becomes more important, but here it's not that important. We've talked about that many times. It's a question of good judgment, not whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, a liberal or a conservative.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you feel when the appointment finally came through?
Well, I felt very good. I was very happy to have the appointment. I felt very proud to have the chance to do something about what I had criticized for a long time. My only criticism.